Okay, we'll get started. So everyone, welcome to our second installment of Trauma Module 2 on distal radius fractures. This evening, we're going to be doing a journal club discussing a few articles on the topic. So again, I'm Marilyn Hang. I'm an orthopedic trauma surgeon, soon to be practicing in Brighton, Massachusetts. On tonight's journal club, we have Dr. Nina Su, who is Associate Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at Emory University. She's also the Associate Upper Extremity Fellowship Director and the Clinical Director of their Bioskills and Biomechanics Laboratory. We also have Dr. Casey Sabeg, who is an Assistant Professor and Vice Chair of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio. She's also a major in the U.S. Air Force. So again, tonight is a journal club where we will be discussing three articles with the focus on current topics in distal radius fractures. At the end of the session, you will be able to critically appraise and review 2 to 3 current journal articles addressing important or current research questions or controversies. And we will be looking to apply and discuss the scientific evidence to inform our recommendations as to potential changes in practice. So again, tonight's agenda, we've got the three articles. We are going to go through them in order, and you will see that we have a pretty common format that we're going to use for the critical appraisal. We will try and leave some time for questions and answers at the end, but please do, as we're discussing, put in your questions as we go along. And then before we get started, just a plug for our upcoming webinars for AO Trauma Fellows, Tuesday, May 6th, a deformity and surgical planning webinar. Our final session of this distal radius fracture modules will be a fireside chat where we will discuss distal radius fracture cases. And then module 3 of the trauma series will begin with a webinar in May on complex elbow fracture dislocations. So these are our three articles that we're going to be discussing, and we're going to follow the same format, which is we're not here just to talk about, you know, whether we like the articles or what we thought of them, but in addition to discussing them, we really want to perform a critical appraisal, which in my view is the reason to do journal clubs. So we're going to sort of revisit the same 4 theme questions, which is, does this study address a clearly focused question? Did the study use valid methods to address the question? Are the valid results of the study important? And then are these valid important results applicable to my patient or patient population? So we'll get started, and hopefully everybody did have some opportunity to peruse their articles that were posted when you registered. But the first article that we're going to be discussing is from the Journal of Clinical Orthopedics and Trauma. It was published this year in 2025, titled Radiographic Outcomes of Dorsal Spanning Plate With and Without Volar Plate Fixation for Comminuted Intra-Articular Distal Radius Fractures. And this was performed at Rutgers in New Jersey. So again, we're going to sort of go through the same 4 questions with a little bit of different discussion points. We're going to go through what type of study is this, what question is the study addressing, and then we're going to discuss whether we thought the methods the authors used to answer the research question were valid, and then we'll discuss their results. So to start first, what type of study is this? Again, hard to tell a little bit just from the title, but you're going to look to find this either at the end of the introduction, the beginning of the methods, or somewhere in the abstract. But like all of the articles that we are studying, this is a retrospective observational cohort study. And then I was going to ask Nina, with your background and masters of epidemiology, do you want to go through just very quickly and briefly, how does this impact what we're going to think about when we appraise this article, and what differences might we consider to a prospective study or a randomized control trial?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think one of the things is obviously not all the gold standard, what we really aim for are the randomized control trials, but sometimes we can't do that. And these retrospective studies are helpful to us to kind of look back at everything that has happened for a patient population. So the downside, of course, of retrospective, you can't control your patient population, you can't control the intervention, you can't control the demographics that you're enrolling necessarily, and the timing of your follow-ups. And I think that's one of the downsides of retrospective studies, which is the benefit of prospective studies, because you can take a question and you can formulate a trial or a study looking specifically at the question and trying to like minimize and mitigate some of the limitations of this study that we'll probably discuss later on in terms of the retrospective nature of it.
So the next question that we're going to very briefly go is, what is the research question that this study is trying to address? And for myself, whenever I'm reviewing an article, whenever I'm doing a journal club, to me, this is actually the most important thing that I'm looking at. And there are different frameworks that people can use, but one that I particularly like, both when I'm reviewing, but also when I'm trying to formulate my own study, is the PCOTS formulation, which PCOTS stands for population, intervention, comparator, outcomes, timing, and setting. It works very well for studies that are cohort studies in general. Anything that has a comparative effectiveness sort of intent, it actually works very nicely, hence the intervention and comparator parts of the framework. But even other studies, you can use this. And I've used this to characterize and define questions from anything to economic questions to even biomechanical ones. So in this article, the population was distal radius fractures being treated with a dorsal spanning plate. The intervention, there were really two groups they looked at. One was a group of patients who were treated with the dorsal spanning plate and also a volar locking plate. Those were compared to a group of which the patients were treated with just the dorsal spanning plate alone. The outcomes, which you're often going to find described in a good study in the methods section, were really radiographic parameters of radial height, radial inclination, ulnar variance, volar tilt, and the teardrop angle. So somewhat of our classic radiographic parameters when we're talking about distal radius fractures. And those were looked at both at the time of dorsal spanning plate application, as well as at the time of removal of the plate. The timing of the study, it was a retrospective cohort study. So they looked at a cohort of patients over a 10-year period from July 2013 to July 2023. And the setting of the study was a single academic center, specifically Rutgers Health in New Jersey. So when I go through the PCOTS formulation and then I basically try and put it into a sentence, the research question that I garnered from this study was, in adult distal radius fracture patients with multifragmentary and intraarticular fracture treated surgically with dorsal spanning plate with and without locking plate at a single academic center over a 10-year period, the radiographic parameters of outcome will be similar in patients undergoing DSP and volar locking plate to patients undergoing just DSP fixation alone. So that's actually what their hypothesis essentially will be. And it is somewhat of a null hypothesis that they felt. So Nina, Casey, we're going to start first. If you guys can, you know, I guess, critique the question and the hypothesis. Really, is this an important research question to us? Do we care?
My short answer to that is yes. I know we all have different approaches to the use of dorsal spanning plates, and we've discussed this previously. Nina and I were discussing the influence of the dorsal spanning bridge plate since its inception. And I think it's an amazing tool, especially in the setting of a very comminuted intraarticular distal radius fracture. Particularly, my bias is to use it in patients that are older. Number one, because they tolerate the restrictions of not having wrist range of motion for that period of time afterwards. And number two, because I think their tissues are a little bit more amenable to utilizing that construct, and the power of the bridge plate in my hands is just to get length on a very, very bad intra-articular fracture in order to just let those pieces heal by themselves. Because the alternative is a volar locking plate versus fragment specific fixation, which often aren't able to capture a lot of those pieces, and we can't get an anatomic result anyway. So a little bit, it's a settling for what we know is going to be not an ideal outcome in terms of volar tilt and teardrop angle, but a stable healed wrist that has a good range of motion. So that's my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree completely with Casey. This is a very important question. And, you know, prior to being at Emory and then doing call and seeing patients at Grady Trauma Center, which is one of the busiest in the US, it's funny, my usage of the bridge place has increased substantially, actually. The power of it, I think it's, you can, for distal radius, as we all know, they all have different personalities and you have to have multiple ways of dealing with it. And the bridge plate is a great way of dealing with it to help not only temporize, but also to actually fix the fracture, because it really relies on the ligamentous taxis. And some of these fragments, particularly when they're completely smashed within the joint itself, it's hard to get fixation in those. And so if you just use the ligaments, you pull out to length and you can get it into relative position. It helps offload so that you don't have any loss of reduction at the actual joint surface. So I think this is a great question, because it's like, I do both techniques. So sometimes I do bridge plate alone, and if I'm able to get good records, sometimes I will use a volar lock plate, so like a hybrid construct, to really get those pieces. Particularly, as Casey mentioned, I do use these for older individuals. It's great in older individuals for their soft tissues particularly, but I also use it in younger patients. It's very helpful. And conjunction with the volar locking plate it's increased substantially over time. And I found this paper quite interesting that they're looking into this.
Yeah, I think too, like sometimes you'll have a patient that you go in with a plan of like, I'm going to try to fix this with a volar plate. And if I'm going to have a bridge plate in the room, right? And then there's other patients where you say like, I'm just going to go straight to a bridge plate. So that's why I think that the research question is very relevant.
Yeah. And I think it's like those critical volar ulnar pieces, particularly if you don't capture it, but even if you capture it, sometimes that capture is very tenuous. So sometimes using to neutralize the construct off the volar ulnar segment can be helpful with the bridge plate. I've noticed as well through experience.
All right. So if we're all sort of happy that this is an important, what's a worthwhile question to endeavor, our next job at looking at this article and appraising it is to decide really were the methods the author used to answer the research question valid. And so what I have here is actually just some examples of questions that one might ask in a critical appraisal for a cohort study, for one that's looking at prognosis of outcome, that you might use to judge whether the methods were valid. And essentially what we're looking for is there any evidence of bias that would make us essentially not believe the results as they are reported to us? So I'll just go through quickly the sort of four questions, and then again, we can discuss what we thought of the methods, what we thought about whether there were any areas that had us concerned for bias. So one is, was the defined representative sample of patients assembled at a common point in the course of their disease, really looking at the cohort, the inclusion-exclusion criteria? Was patient follow-up sufficiently long and complete? Were outcome criteria either objective or applied in a blind fashion? You might also ask, was it the outcome criteria that we care about? And if any subgroups were identified, was any adjustment for important prognostic factors taken place?
Yeah, so I think this, because this is a retrospective study, they obviously just looked at all of their distal radius fractures. They did have it AO type 2-3 C3s. So they at least tried to, like, because obviously you wouldn't use this technique for some of the distal radius fractures. So they did try to, like, get their patient population to be somewhat similar as best that they could. And then I do think it's, like, essentially to union, and these were radiographic. These were not clinical outcomes, which I think is obviously you wouldn't be able to get it with for this patient population retrospectively.
Yeah, I agree. And I think for time of follow-up, that's one thing I would probably have liked to see more of. It ended at the time of bridge plate removal, which for them was 23 weeks. And for other people might be shorter periods of time. I usually take mine out at 3 months, but I think longer follow-up would have been helpful here. I think there's probably also a little bit of a measurement error because they don't mention who was radiographically measuring these. They don't mention which of the authors and what level of experience they have. So that's one thing I would critique with their methods. But otherwise, I think the outcomes were very objective.
Yes. I mean, they chose, I guess, time of plate removal, because at that point, normally for most of their patients, they were getting x-rays right after. But then I might assume maybe variable follow-up of how often they see somebody after. For radiographic parameters, do you guys see a big difference in, I guess, later malunion after you, like, so can bad things still happen to the radiographs after you take it off, and for how long abouts?
Well, I think if you don't have union, you can obviously still lose your reduction. I think once you have union, it's like maybe you develop arthritis or some other conditions, but I don't think you'll lose your reduction once your bone has healed.
Okay. And then again, the radiographic outcomes, a little bit of a convenience choice of outcomes. Do you agree? Like, what ideally are you, would you want to choose when you're saying, okay, I'm going to use the volar plating or not in the dorsal. I want to know how these patients do. What other outcomes would be better or more, not necessarily better, but would you choose for a study?
Yeah, I think any objective patient outcome score for range of motion or functionality, like a DASH score, would be helpful, or even just range of motion measurements.
Yeah, I think clinical outcomes is the obvious missing factor of this manuscript. I think personally they were smart, given the retrospective nature, to really just focus on something at least they could actually have for every patient that they were looking at. And their plate removal time, just as Casey mentioned, I also removed mine fairly quickly. I actually removed them around 2 months. So essentially once it's healed, then I remove them. But these were I think it was 23 weeks and 20 weeks essentially for plate removal. So these patients were well healed at that time. So I think clinical data would have been interesting. I think that would have given us a lot of information, like pain, DASH, Michigan Hand Questionnaire, any patient reported outcomes, I think would have been helpful.
Okay.
Although they did put that as a limitation in their study. So they recognized that.
Yeah. So potentially also something that if you're, in the group where you take off your dorsal spanning plates earlier than 5-6 months, maybe again, the methods used here, the results they garner aren't going to necessarily be what you find in your own patient population. So that being said, and again, their results were pretty much no big difference. Where do you guys take this? I mean, where do you put this in the pantheon of results? Does it change anything in your practice? Do you use this for counseling or decision making in your practice?
I think, yeah, so for me, it would be the lesson learned here is sometimes we fool ourselves. I mean, I love to get nice x-rays. That's like one of the things that is satisfying about being an orthopedic surgeon. And I think sometimes there's a tendency to want to put a volar plate on there to, get your radiographs to look better. But we're not, to extract from this paper, I would say we're not really changing that radiographic parameter. Whether or not we change their clinical outcomes, that would be another research study to show. But yeah, I don't think it's really going to add much to add that boilerplate if we want to just jump to straight to the bridge plate.
Yeah, I kind of use it as a thought that, oh, okay, so actually the bridge plate alone can provide like fairly comparable radiographic outcomes, which is a little bit of a comfort, right? So when you're doing it, and then hopefully, you know, not doing that second incision, not inducing more trauma to the wrist with your surgery may be beneficial to the patient. I think obviously if there's still like large gaps or something, ligamentous taxis helps or something, but it's still like big steps. Obviously, I still think it's a little bit biased because those patients probably had a boilerplate put on, right? Yeah. So I feel like they would have, I don't think any surgeon would be like, oh, bridge plate alone. I think you still have to look at the personality of the fracture. And so if there's steps or gaps or like wide displacements or stuff, I do think still the boilerplate. So I think it's a slightly different patient population probably, that these were highly selected in the retrospective study. So the patient that just got a spanning plate, probably when they did the ligamentous tract, they had the traction, the fracture probably came together very, very well. Whereas the one with the volar plate, it might've had widely displaced fragments, right? So I still think you need to take care of the fragments. You just can't use this as a technique alone. You still have to understand that the fractures may be different that these folks treated, even if the pre-op like AO classification was the same.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, and we often can't account for in the retrospective where decision-making surgically, they say, was left up to the treating surgeon. And we don't know whether that treating surgeon had, you know, criteria that was different and have factors that, again, weren't taken into account. There were no subgroup analyses that were done in this paper. And it may be because the authors retrospectively were not able to pick up what might have been subgroups that would have introduced a selection bias as to the treatment from it. So that's always a big sort of caution when we're looking at these retrospective studies, is it really was, we don't know whether or not there was something that wasn't reported that influenced the decision-making from it.
Yeah, there's and, for sure selection bias, for sure.
Yeah, some of the, again, obviously a randomized controlled trial, which would seem to be probably fairly doable in this type of study to answer this type of question. Other things might be if you have a sort of a natural experiment where you've got a group kind of similar patient populations, but one group that like they always treat with dorsal spanning plate and volar plate, because that's just like what they were trained to do and that's their belief, versus another center that is like only dorsal spanning plate. If you had everything else equal, potentially that might be a natural experiment, but then you'd also have to very much be doing sort of making sure that you account for the assumptions from it. All right. Let's look questionly. Okay, no questions yet. So again, if you have any questions regarding the paper, since we are going sequentially, please do ask them as we're discussing them. So that is, you know, basically as we're talking from it. But we can go on now to our second paper, which is also, again, I'm going to go straight to the answer for the first one. It's also a retrospective cohort study, but this was by Campbell et al. And published in 2025 in the Hand Journal, looking at the outcomes of volar plating for distal radius fractures based on surgical timing. So again, this too is a retrospective observational cohort study. And if we looked at the research question, they were looking at patients 18 years and older, so adult patients with distal radius fractures who were treated with volar locked plating ORF. The two groups that they compared, the intervention we can call as those who received surgery within 12 days from their injury, and the comparator being those who received their surgery greater than 12 days from injury. Their main outcome was unplanned reoperation rate, but they also did look at secondary outcomes of operative time, tourniquet time, and post-op dash score. This too was a single academic medical center, And the timing retrospectively was a cohort from 2017 to 2020. So this one I phrased in the form of the actual research question, which was an adult distal radius fracture patients treated with volar locked plating ORF at a single academic center between 2017 and 2020. Is there a difference in unplanned reoperation rate between patients operated on within 12 days of injuries and patients operated on between 12 days from their injury? So again, Nina, Casey, what do you think of the research question and what they were looking at?
So this is another important question for timing of distal radius fractures, when you're going to fix them, because there's tends to be, more so than some other fractures, there tends to be some callus formation early, and by early for me it usually is less than 3 weeks. So in that time frame, anything after 3 weeks to me is almost like you're taking down a healed fracture or doing an osteotomy through that healed fracture. So this is a very important question in terms of does the timing of fixation affect reoperation or complications. In my opinion, the date of that, we'll get into that, I think, a little bit later, but the timeline they picked is a little bit up for question, but yes, the timing is very important.
I'm not sure about ACE or something. I usually like to get my distal radiuses in definitely within the 2 weeks. It just makes that a little bit easier. The problem is like after 12 days is 12 day, like a comparator, like let's say 14 days versus 4 weeks or something. Those are obviously very different fractures. And I think it's a little different because of the callus, the healing, as was mentioned by Casey. So I think this is a very important question, because you do wonder, like, am I doing harm? Is this, the outcome's going to be, can I wait until next week to do this? Or do I have to kind of put this immediately this week and put this on my list to do? I think most surgeons tend to want to do this ASAP just because it makes it easier for us. So I think this is a great question, but obviously, like this paper too, kind of noted that how some of the later patients actually had more surgeon experience. So perhaps indicative of perhaps more complicated cases, or patients, I think, that were not well enough to actually get done surgery early. So maybe this was outside the control of the surgeon.
Yeah. So that takes us very much into the methods, which again, if you just read the abstract, you just kind of read the concluding paragraph, you could overlook this. And I wanted to point it out because again, this was retrospective. And, I can ask you guys to comment briefly on, you know, was the sample representative? But more interesting to me was my second question, which is, the cutoff point for 12 days, was that valid, used to define the two cohorts? Again, Casey, you had mentioned that sort of you used 2 weeks a priori. So, I mean, 12 versus 14, sure. Again, we can talk into a little bit of how they chose to define the cutoff point, which for me was very notable in that they didn't choose the cutoff point a priori.
Right. Yeah, they kind of used the data to make the question, which is an interesting approach. And whether or not that, you know, we all kind of have some inclinations, I think, to find research questions and to seek data that supports what our practice is. But I think this probably is true, right? So I don't think it's a coincidence that they found that area under the curve at 12 days. Because that's, as Nina said, like most of us like to do them within 2 weeks. If you're doing it after that, it's a headache, and you're knowing that you're going to go in there for a little bit more difficulty and higher difficulty case if it's a delayed presentation.
Yeah, like the ROCA analysis they did, like to determine after the fact, they kind of looked at the data, found the 12 days. Their area on the curve is like 0.62 though. So it does make it a little bit difficult whether this is super representative. And I think, but although granted, they identified that as like a limitation in their study. So I think actually 12 days, ironically, their study kind of is like the threshold that most surgeons kind of like to get it under. But I think probably usually we like to do a priority definitions when we're choosing our samples.
Yeah, and then for follow-up on this one too, I would also critique, I think the follow-up could be longer. It again was like in that 6 month time frame, which you could have later complications of that, especially when you're talking about dysarthrous fracture complications like tendon ruptures and that sort of thing. So that would be a little bit more relevant, like having a longer time point on these.
Yeah.
And the last question was just, you know, in their results, they mentioned you off, basically, they differed the cutoff threshold. And then they just commented on the percentages of like operations, reoperations, which again, sure, numbers to me, all varying ones, like again, by performing the ROC analysis, they already found the one number that was going to show the biggest predictor of the reoperation rate. What did you think of the actual outcome of reoperation rate? Is that best outcome, surrogate outcome? Would you choose other things?
I think, again, I would choose clinical outcomes. And I don't think it's a coincidence that they're not acquiring them, because that's the hardest thing to get in trauma patients is, you know, robust long-term clinical outcomes, range of motion, patient function, DASH scores, all that stuff is just very onerous to collect in follow-up. So, you know, it's easy for us to say, yeah, like that's what we would want to see. It's still answering a question with some valid endpoint outcomes, right? Like reoperation complications, all important things to know.
Yeah, the reoperations, like if you think about it, it's very low, right? So like in the less than 12 days, it was 16 reoperations. Over 12 days, it was 10 reoperations. So I wouldn't say it was a massive difference between the two. And it's not a lot, right? Like obviously the reoperation rates for dysarthrodes in a very short time, unless like your hardware has fallen apart or something, or you have a very early complication of a tendon rupture, or maybe like a screw causes attritional rupture or something like that, or the hardware is very painful. Like usually the reoperation rate is relatively low, unless it's obviously a bridge plate, which has to come out. I do think it's interesting though that the operative time or tourniquet time was not different between the two. So that's good to know.
Yeah, I agree. I think one other thing that I noticed that was interesting about their method, or I guess the results, is that the less than 12 day group, the average was 6 days, right? So actually less than a week for average. And then for the greater than 12 days group, the average was 15 days. And so I think that also says something too, is that these groups were very different, right? It's not like you're taking an average of 10 versus an average of 11. I think they actually did get some pretty good time points to make their groups different. And in terms of the importance of like 1 week versus 2 weeks, I think they did show some valid results on reoperation rates and tourniquet time, operative time, all of that stuff. So just reaffirming that 2 week mark is a good mark to use. I would also be interested to see longer ones if they had that available as well, but we tend to not fix those after, you know, after a couple of weeks. It's more let it heal and then do an osteotomy later.
It is interesting. They're most common, the symptomatic, if you excluded the symptomatic hardware removal, they had a similar reoperation rate between the two.
Yeah, that was right about to be my question. You know, when we think about what were the actual results, reoperation rate is a pretty broad outcome. A lot of people sometimes tend to use it as a nice composite because it gives you most numbers to run your stats with of actual events. But again, you can reoperate for a number of different reasons. Did the paper mention and delve into what were those different reasons? And then when you delve into that, does that impact how you view the results and whether, again, do these results have the same, I guess, impression to you? And does it change anything in your practice?
Well, the reoperations, like, so if you took out the symptomatic hardware removal, then it ended up being very similar. So it was revision ORIF, infection, tendon rupture, delayed carpal tunnel syndrome requiring surgical release. So I think it's like the number of those reoperations were relatively low. I don't know if this particular paper would necessarily change my practice. I think it just kind of, to me, reaffirms, like, try to get to it earlier. But I would do that anyways, right? Just because for other reasons, like soft tissue, patient, like, being able to get them back to all their activities, I think I would probably still do this. I'm not so sure if this particular paper would tell me, like, oh, like, I'm good to leave it till, like, day 12. Like, I still yeah. don't know that. That's what I would take from
it. I agree. It's not a practice changing, but it is a practice affirming. You know, and when you're in a training institution and the residents always do this, we have a hand fracture clinic where the residents are seeing a lot of these, and we we'll cast a lot of distal radius fractures in elderly patients here still, which is pretty cool. But we'll bring them back for a weekly cast at radiographs in the cast. Those 1 weekers in the older population in general, that'll fall off pretty rapidly. You got to get them in quickly, because if you're seeing them at the 1 week mark, then you got to get them into surgery like within the next week in order to make it into that interval. So again, it's more practice affirming, but an interesting result, I think.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll use these papers, not necessarily because it's going to change my practice. So again, you know, I think when we talk about a lot of surgical timing papers, you go into it and sometimes you, no matter what the paper says, whatever's going on in your institution, maybe you can make some practice improvements to try and get patients in quicker. You know, if you're completely sort of off the mark, it maybe has you sort of do a little bit of a reflection of your practices. But in a lot of cases, we're all operating under the as soon as possible mentality, that it's not like we're just sitting around with open ORs kind of saying, no, you wait until then from it. We sort of do it as we have the capacity. But sometimes these papers are important to me because it can, depending on what the results are, it can give me an idea to have a conversation with patients about prognosis. So kind of what I take the most is, again, if we take out the symptomatic hardware, and I can ask you guys to posit on, you know, what do you think was the difference of why symptomatic, you know, was it, you know, after a number of time, we're not putting on the plates on straight, we're putting on too long screws, whatever. But apart from that, it actually somewhat reaffirms to me that if for whatever reason I have to send a patient out or it is beyond 12 days, I could probably tell them that the really bad complication outcomes, you know, the reasons I really don't want to have to be going back to do a reoperation, those are kind of the same. So in some ways, it actually gives me sort of reassurance that if I don't get to them in the 12 days that they posited, it's not, again, I can give a prediction to patients of what we might expect, which may be somewhat counterintuitive if what we're trying to get, what I get out of this paper that is meaningful.
I'm going to be honest, the biggest thing for this was like, oh, wow, Rothman must be really nice. Because I remember when I started my practice, I got the terrible ones all the time. I was like, wow, surgeon experience in years got
the hard ones. Partners take the hard one.
That's right. I was like, dude, that doesn't make any sense. Anyways, that was just an aside. I was like, oh, Rothman's a great institution, apparently.
Okay, that's also good to know from it.
Yes.
All right, we've got a little under 20 minutes left, but we're going to go to our third one, which, again, also has a question of timing. So this was also published in the Hand Journal. This was last year, 2024, and it was the effect of time to surgery on surgical site infection and open distal radius fractures, a review of the ACS Trauma Quality Improvement Program database. So again, retrospective observational cohort study, perhaps one of the big differences between our first two is that this was a large database study. So our population were patients who underwent ORF of open distal radius fractures within 1 week of ED presentation that had complete data entered into the TQIP database. And for anybody who doesn't know, the trauma quality I think improvement database is the American College of Surgeons. It's part of their National Trauma Data Bank system, where if you get admitted to the hospital as a quote unquote trauma patient, and they have all these criteria, you go into the database. So the authors here used the TQIP database and searched for all the patients who underwent ORF of an open distal radius fracture that were in the database. The intervention that they looked at, again, they actually had three cohort groups, but we'll call the intervention those that had surgery less than 24 hours from presentation. The two comparator groups were surgery 24 to 72 hours from presentation and surgery between 72 hours and 7 days from presentation. Again, 7 days is sort of a artifact of TQIP, which is that was the cutoff of entering into the database. Patients who had surgery beyond 7 days didn't get entered into TQIP. Their main outcome was surgical site infection. They used the NTDS definition of superficial infection, deep infection, or osteomyelitis. They lumped together deep infection and osteomyelitis. Again, you can see I have this underlined in question mark because this is where I actually did have to go back and read the article like a couple of times to make sure I wasn't missing this. Because at one point they mentioned that their outcome were only those surgical site infections occurring within 1 week postoperatively. And we can get to some discussion on that. The timing, essentially a 10-year period without 2015 in there because I believe the change between ICD-9 and ICD-10 codes. And again, it was the American College of Surgeons TQIP database. So we'll go right into it. And again, research question. So an open distal radius fracture patients treated with ORF in the ACS TQIP database from 2011 to 2021, excluding 2015. Is there a difference in surgical site infection between patients operated on less than 24 hours from presentation, operated on between 24 hours and 72 hours, and patients operated on between 72 hours and 7 days from presentation? And I'm going to bring up a comment in our Q&A from Dr. Zayer Ong, who is getting to what I'm alluding to, is 5 to 10 day is window of opportunity for operation, which I don't know if it was, and Dr. Ong, you can say, was that window of opportunity for operation or commenting on the fact that after 7 days, you don't get into the TQIP database, but there were still operations that might have happened. Who knows? Again, these were open distal radius fractures. So we might start with that. Is, are there any open distal radius fractures that are getting operated on after 7 days?
Maybe poke holes. I think all open distal radius fractures aren't created equal. So there's some, you know.
I think that's the biggest issue. First of all, this question is obviously very important because that's really the thing is like, I remember very, very early in my training, like open fractures were like, you had to get that washed out and stuff like that immediately. Now I think there has been data to suggest you don't need to do it that night type of thing. But now it's like, we're trying to extend this out, like for distal radius fracture, for open distal radius fractures, because distal radius fracture are very well perfused, right? So it's like, and are these farm injuries or, as Casey mentioned, are these little poke holes? I think those are very different. And that's one of the downsides of using these very large databases. So all this, although this question is very, very important, the fact that we can't say exactly like which like how many of the was the, I would assume in my mind, like the ones that were operated on later, greater than 3 days, were probably poke holes. Probably within 24 hours are probably going to be like, you know, like the farm injuries, the GSWs or something like bigger or more like dirty in terms of the wound. So I am not so sure whether these are this.
It could be either. And I'm going to go through just kind of a little bit of the, I guess, TQIP. So the TQIP database is patients that come in as quote unquote trauma patients. They have to have a certain ISS, and their inciting injury actually had to have occurred within 14 days prior to them coming into hospital. And it doesn't include any trauma that happens in the hospital from it. So if they got taken in for a car accident and then they fall and break their hip in hospital, like you don't count, you don't report the falling of breaking their hip in hospital. But it is an inpatient database. So the patients that were operated on up to the 7 days, they weren't ones that were sent out home and came back for their operation. They would have had to get their operation on their initial trauma admission, which means if I had to guess, then a lot of the distal radiuses that were going were probably being, I wouldn't say necessarily delayed, or they were going out to the 7 days potentially because of maybe OR availability, probably a little bit of other injuries, maybe like if they're a trauma patient and they had reasons they were for instability that couldn't be taken for their distal radius. But these would not have been, and this goes to question one, is as my understanding of TQIP databases, this would not have included open fractures that were like isolated and were sent home. They would have had to be admitted for 7 days for some reason to be entered into this cohort and not get it within the 24 hours, which, and again, if we looked at their numbers, it wasn't a lot. You know, in 14,486 patients, 10,900 and change were operated in less than 24 hours. About 2,500 went 24 to 72 hours, and only about 1,000 of 14,000 were that long. And if I had to guess, they were probably polytraumas that had other greater issues going on potentially. Which, does that change your thoughts on the study, knowing yeah. that?
I think it's a database study, which has its inherent flaws. You're never going to get this number of patients in any single center, even multi-center study. So it's just, it's part of the flaw of this. And there's not a perfect way to study things. As Nina was saying earlier, yeah, we'd ideally love to have everything studied via prospective randomized controlled trial, but that's not possible. So I think it does have some value, but finding it is kind of, and teasing that out is really, I think, having, as you said, having to read this paper multiple times to just try to truly understand what we're dealing with and like what we can draw from these conclusions. I think probably the biggest thing that I noticed was, and this is another commentary on just database studies, right? You'll get 20,000 patients in the study, so your p-values are significant, but is your effect size significant, right? Does it matter that the infections went from like 0.2% risk to 0.6% risk, you know, between that early and mid-size group? Like that effect size to me, you have a 0.4% increase of a deep infection. If you wait up to between 24 and 72 hours, that to me doesn't seem very significant. When you're talking about 0.2 to 1.2, then you're saying that's a 1% increase in your deep infection rate. So maybe that is significant. Maybe that's something to consider, I think, just diving deep into their results.
Yeah, like I think as Marilyn, you mentioned, like, I think it's a little bit hard with this because it's like, is it from your initials? Because some people will just wash, right? They'll just wash it out. They won't actually do your definitive decision, right? So there's a lot of factors, and these polytraumas, they have to be in hospital, right? I think the good thing about it is like they talked about some of the risk factors associated with like the elevated risk, which I think is important. So those with the polytrauma, the alcohol use and diabetes that were linked to the increased surgical site infection risk in these open disc radius. Like, I think that type of information is useful. It's not that I think, again, there was probably a reason why these surgeries were delayed so long. Maybe it was because polytrauma and like the wrist was on the lower priority of everything else they had going on, which I think would make sense. So, I think this is like one of the studies to try to delineate a very hard yet extremely common problem of what we should do. But I think in general, this also leans towards trying to just do the surgery as definitive surgery as early as possible is essentially the message that's being said here.
Okay. We're going to get to, there's a few questions on this one. So one was, when looking into this related to prior studies, I found a TQIP and NISQIP data frequently only include surgical site infections that occurred during the index admission. That is correct. And that was the whole kind of 1 week that they'd mentioned. Patients that represent to the hospital for infection after discharge may not be captured. Does this study take this into account? And from my understanding, and short answer is no, that this study did not include patients that essentially developed infection after 1 week. And anybody who was readmitted would not have been reflected in the TQIP database because they only capture index trauma admission. When do you guys normally would expect to see infection surgical site issues come up in open distal radius patients?
I think distal radius fractures are probably one of the most rare post-op infections that I see, even in the open ones. As Nina said earlier, like the blood supply is so good and they tend to just heal even in these very bad mangled, you know, contaminated wounds. As long as you get a good debridement and wash them out, they tend to heal pretty well. But yeah, the timeline is going to be later, you know, past 1 week. And so that's another point to think about and one that I would say is lacking on this study.
I would agree with Casey. It's like clinically you see the, you know, maybe very early ones, and those are the really, really dirty ones that you have to do multiple irrigation debridements. Like where I used to practice, there was a lot of farm injuries and stuff like that. So like you can't get mud and manure out the first wash, no matter how well you do it. So that type of patient, that's a very different situation. But I would say the vascularity for the open distal radius are so good. If you do a good washout, you give them antibiotics, like they usually do well. But again, or if they're not, the deep infections will show up a little bit later beyond that 7 days, maybe when they've gone home, now they're going to come back to your office and you're like, now you're worried about it.
Hey, another question was, does time to surgery only include time to definitive fixation? I guess I'm wondering about an initial IND with splinting with the second surgery for definitive RF. How would that be classified? Do you guys recall, now I would assume that all the instances going to the OR would be recorded in TQIP. I don't know if I actually saw them specify one way or the other. So I assumed it was just whichever was the first surgery on the distal radius.
My understanding when I read it was that they didn't specify like a surgery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, that too, again, you would assume that based off the question of infection and open fracture, it was the first IND that they would have wanted to record as being kind of the more important thing. And I think Nina, as you mentioned, that, you know, it could be valid to just do the IND and then come back another time to do the surgery, but they didn't specifically mention it in the paper, which again, you know, if somebody raises a question next time you're writing a paper, maybe spell it out for us so that we know for sure what the definitions were. And that's like, again, for any critical appraisal, that's something, you know, when you're doing the study, you don't think, you're thinking, okay, they're going to get this in obvious, but not always. So, you know, that's a very good point, I think, to mention, because definitions matter a lot, especially when you're doing things retrospectively and it wasn't like all clear cut from the start. Another question was, I do not see time to antibiotics listed in the variables. Should it be assumed that they could not extract that from the database?
Yeah, I agree. I think that was not mentioned.
Yeah, I think.
And they don't also, you know, another thing in this, just a critique too, is like they use injury severity score because I think that's what's available in the TQIPs, whereas we would care more about like a Steele-Anderson grade of open fracture, right? that those are limitations of the, I think, of the TQIP database. I'm not as familiar with it as you, Marilyn, but I'm not sure if they can extract that. I would assume they might be able to.
To be honest, and again, I haven't looked lately at what's in the TQIP. I'm going to assume no, because most of the time, I feel like, again, when you think about TQIP being mostly a general surgery sort of bound one, I think maybe there might be a field of like pre-op antibiotics, yes, no, but I don't think they would have gone to specifics. Certainly, I'll put a plug in for one of the PrEPIT studies that came out in New England Journal, which looked at antibiotic use for fractures in general, where for that study, it was prospective and every single antibiotic was listed. And what I can tell you is we've got a paper coming out, I believe it's going to be JBJS, which pretty much says, one, there really is no great uniformity, like the number of combinations of pre-op antibiotics for open fractures that we had was like in the hundreds of different combinations, but ANSEF still is the leading choice from it, and then ANSEF and a whole bunch of other things. I'm not going to try and summarize it because it's too much. That's like another journal club. But for NISQIP, I'm pretty sure antibiotics aren't listed in there, which is why it becomes a factor of still a question that we have of does it matter which antibiotics they get in terms of open fractures? And the PrEPIT study and PREPARE is using secondary analysis to try and address that. But even then, because it wasn't controlled as one of the variables, we see a wide variation in what was actually used in practice, which can make coming to conclusions difficult, like any sort of retrospective or secondary use of data. So one last question, which I'm not sure where we put it, but if you guys quickly want to comment, does the end result for the fracture fixation depend on the patient profession or age or both? This maybe goes back to the dorsal splaining and volar. Patient age, you know, my residents are always asking right-handed, left-handed, what do you use your hand, do you factor that into your decision making?
I do. I think it matters, like, but then again, I don't think your chronological age necessarily. I think there's different, like very, very active 80-year-olds, very non-active 80-year-olds, are they require their use. So I think it's actually a combination of everything involved. I think that's why I think distal radiuses are so difficult and cause us so much problems, and why it's like you can have awful x-rays and they do perfectly well. Like some older individuals, the x-rays look terrible, but they are very happy, super functional, back to gardening, doing everything they want. So I think everything kind of culminates to the good result for the patient.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely tailor it to that person and have the discussion with them on, you know, what surgery and if surgery, and if so, what surgery.
Okay. And we'll end on a methodology question. I actually love this. Is there a database better fitted for orthopedics instead of TQIP?
I don't know. I don't do a bunch of database research. I actually have one of my residents looking into a database, and we're sort of running into the same type of problem. So I think any of them are all going to be very similar. I don't know if you guys know of any others.
I don't do a lot of these database studies. I think all of them have like their pros and cons. So I don't think there's like a one leader that's like the absolute best, at least in my understanding. I think they all have their pros and their cons. And I think they have a role in our literature for sure. But I'm not aware, unless Marilyn, you're aware.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with Casey and Nina in that the short answer is no. There are uses. But I think kind of the message is that if you are going to be looking to a database to try and address your research question, it is very important that you know exactly what the research question you're asking, and that you really know what the limitations and what those fields are of the database that you intend to use, because potentially you find out that the database you were hoping to use really doesn't have the information to answer your question, and you should either keep looking or decide, can you answer this question with a different research design that doesn't involve a big database? Because I think we're probably still, you know, again, the holy grail of all like clinical research is that wonderful database that is complete prospective and has no mistakes in it. I don't think that exists. Again, a lot of the bigger studies that we do, such as the metric studies, the prepare PREPIT studies, they're trying to create big databases that are prospectively built, but they are still also built on an initial question. So those databases work great to answer the question that they were designed for. You can still use them for secondary analysis, but you're still going to have potentially some inherent, well, we didn't ask that, or we didn't collect that. And it's like, you, whenever you design your study, you have to look at your research question and really evaluate, does it answer my question? And really kind of go through the critical appraisal before you do the project, almost, from it. But we are out of time. So thank you, Dr. Sue, Dr. Sevig, for your great discussion. I hope everybody on found it useful, and you went through a little bit here. So final plug that I'm going to have is our final session of this module is our fireside chat, where we will be going through some cases to really talk and try and put it all together with some pearls and pitfalls and some expert basically taking you through their thought processes in dealing with these fractures. So again, everyone, thank you very much for joining, and have a good evening.